Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by.
So today, as I kind of mentioned in the blur, I'm going to pull a bit of a Tim Plett, and I'm going to do what I did on my summer vacation report, as he likes to do when he comes back. But it wasn't really technically a vacation, because I was working the whole time. But, you know, when you're traveling and working, it's sort of, they blur, right? Essentially, I'll tell you today what I learned about Ireland while I was supposed to be teaching about Ireland. Which, you know, teaching is one of those things where, you know, you think, I have to be an expert in something, you know, and then I'll teach it. But then you realize as you start teaching, you know, how little you actually know. And it can be a really interesting learning experience. Yeah, you can sort of read about, you know, I was saying, people asked me how it was, you know, everybody I talked to that had gone said it's so green that you don't believe how green it is. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I've seen green. And then you go there and you're like, I've never seen green. Like this, just verdant, you know, everywhere. And of course it rains all the time, which I don't love, but it sure is beautiful because of it. So. So this isn't just about, you know, I'm not just going to... you know, slideshow. This isn't like going to, you know, uncle whoever's house for a slideshow after they've been to Hawaii or something. I do, you know, there's a lot of things that I was thinking about as, you know, it wasn't just sort of learning facts and figures and all that about Ireland, but lots of interesting things about the history and the way, particularly thinking about this sort of Catholic-Protestant divide that's really defined the country for the last 600 years or so. And these sort of echoes of colonialism that go with that, and they're all connected. And just sort of, you know, as I was kind of preparing to go there and we're teaching here, try to find art and things like that, was my job, was to bring in literature and other things that could comment on Ireland. So one of the things I did was weighed heavily on this guy, Bono, the singer of U2, who has written a lot about you know, this sort of divides in Ireland. They're an Irish band. What we're going to do is we're going to look at some of two of the songs that sort of deal directly with what's called the Troubles, and thinking about what they have to say about the notion of peace and the unsettled nature of ceasefires and all of that kind of stuff. We'll sort of all unpack that. But first, we're going to do a little bit of a history lesson. I'll try and get through this quickly. 30,000 years of history, very quickly. So, Ireland, the earliest inhabitants, the earliest evidence of human beings there dates back to about 31,000 BCE, so a very, very long time ago. You know, when you think about what else is happening in the world, not a lot in terms of humans, there is settlements and evidence of that. So, for most of that time, most of that 33,000 years, they remained isolated and independent, the people who were there. This is where Celtic religions and traditions started to form, much closer to our time than 30,000 years ago. And a lot of the legends that we associate with Ireland, so people like Finn McCool, who is not just that restaurant on Grand Avenue, and Cahulain, these sort of figures that are the pre-Christian Irish tradition. Ireland, unlike England, was not colonized by Rome. The Romans got to England, they sort of took out whatever was going on there. They looked across the ocean and saw Ireland, and they called it Hibernia, which means like winter, right? They sort of saw and they said, not worth it. That place looks awful. I don't know what time of year they went, but they just decided they weren't going to go. So a win for the Irish back then to not get taken over by the Romans, which is never pleasant. So it wasn't until really about 400 CE that Christianity came in. So St. Patrick, we all know from March, came over. He was an English, missionary, kind of whatever, a monk kind of thing. It's funny, every St. Patrick's Day I have these cousins who post on Facebook that St. Patrick was actually Italian. But the reasoning behind that is because England at the time was a Roman colony, so by that logic, Jesus was also Italian, I guess. There was no Italy back then, but anyway, I always want to comment on it, but I'm like, yeah, I'm just going about it. Not worth it. So anyway, St. Patrick came along and was a big reason for a lot of the conversions to Christianity. He had this effort of converting the sort of chieftains and kings and all of that to Christianity. And so back then, if the leader of your group became a different religion, then you all became a different religion. But it wasn't, it wasn't sort of this aggressive kind of thing, because there was a lot of blurring of these Celtic belief systems into Catholicism. So if you've ever seen like a Celtic cross, for instance, this sort of obvious cross shape, but with all of these sort of winding images and all that sort of stuff, that's the Celtic moving into the Christian. And a lot of the stories, a lot of the legends are old Celtic legends that then get put onto the saints. So people like St. Bridget, St. Patrick, did not ever drive the saints out of Ireland. The snakes of Ireland. There's never been snakes in Ireland. But this was an old thing that sort of got subplanted onto him later. So they were living in this sort of, more or less peaceful, Christian-Celtic hybrid for about 300 years until the Vikings show up. So the Vikings, 8th century, they come in, establish a bunch of mostly coastal cities. So Dublin, for instance, originated with the Vikings, and were a little bit more aggressive, but they set up, they drastically changed the economic, political, cultural life of Ireland. So by around 1000, they had driven the Vikings out, and they were able to do that because they mostly were just on the edge of the island. 1169, though, the Normans show up, right? So the Normans, this is Britain, this is, their precursors, and they take over Ireland. So that was the first time that they really brought British culture to Ireland in a major way. It really hasn't disappeared over the last 900 years. It's still very much a tension between those two cultures, and a blurring between them as well. Now, throughout the next 900 years, there's a lot of back and forth, but Ireland essentially became a British colony and sort of stayed one with some slight gaps of independence into the 20th century. So they had, one of these examples in the 16th century, they had driven the British out. In the 17th century, this guy Oliver Cromwell comes along and just a bloodbath of invasion of the Irish people, takes it over again for England. But also around this time, you have not just sort of national divides, you have the first religious divide, because you have this guy Henry VIII, who I'm sure many of you have heard of, really wanted to divorce his wife. The Pope said no, so he said, I'm starting a new religion, and that's how we got Anglicanism. And so what happened was, of course, as they now are invading Ireland, which is very Catholic, they said, no, it's not enough for us to just, you can be part of Britain, you also have to be Protestants, right? You have to be Anglicans. So started wiping out Catholic churches, Catholic people, making all sorts of laws to push Catholicism away and establish Protestantism as a part. It's colonizers too, right? They don't just bring sort of good thing, they sort of need you to take on everything or else. So in this time, we have the establishment of what's called the plantation system, in which vast amounts of land was given to British and Scottish settlers if they would go to Ireland. And the term plantation doesn't just refer to sort of like we think about the South plantation, where you grow things, but also the sort of plantation of people and culture into Ireland, right? So again, sort of planting this, the roots of this to take hold. Now, the native Irish who had been there their families had been there for generations, their ancestors were basically, their land was taken away from them, and they were allowed to be peasants working this land that had been in their family for generations. The wiping out of Catholicism was destroying Catholic churches, changing these Catholic churches to the Church of England, but also disenfranchising Catholics, making them, barring them from land ownership, participating in government, education, and segregating cities. So basically, if you were Catholic back then, you had zero rights in Ireland. You couldn't, you had no way. And when I say Catholic, this isn't just talking about a religious sort of thing, right? There's a blending of these two. Basically, that's a synonym for native Irish. So it's not like you could just sort of be like, well, no, I'm not Catholic anymore. I'm Protestant. Love the king. give me my land back. Because that was just sort of the surface level, right? It was really about keeping the indigenous population down and sort of in service. So jumping ahead, 1800, we have this thing called the Act of Union. This was an agreement between Britain and Ireland to form a new country, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. Up until this point, Ireland had been a colony, but it had maintained its own parliament while still being under the rule of British monarchy. Now, that's a little bit of a tricky thing, too, because only the Anglo-Irish, so people who were British originally and came to Ireland, could actually be in parliament. Native Irish couldn't be in there. So basically, it was a British government anyway. But what happened was the British were trying to consolidate power, and so they wanted to get their ruling powers away from Ireland so they couldn't be influenced, so they would be more loyal to the crown. And so this act in 1800 dissolved the independent Irish government and gave Ireland a few seats in the British Parliament. And so the reason they had done this, the sort of reason they were saying it was because they, of course, had just seen two revolutions, right? France and America, and they didn't want an Irish revolution. They didn't want to fight that war. All of that kind of stuff, they didn't want to pay for it. So they figured, we'll just consolidate power over here and tell them it's a good thing, and they'll buy it, which, of course, they didn't, but it happened anyway. What's interesting, though, is there was support for this in Ireland, especially amongst the Catholics, who felt that a British parliament would be more sympathetic to the Catholic cause, which I'm not sure why they thought that, probably some clever propaganda somewhere along the way, but they were sort of in support of this. But it really, of course, didn't work out that way. And it quickly became clear that life wasn't going to get better for the native Irish, especially for the Catholics, because after this happened, they were still far from ownership and all of that sort of stuff. As well, what happened in the cities is that many of the wealthy British ruling class who had been living in Ireland were then like, well, I don't need to live here anymore. I'm going to go back to England because that's where my work is. That's where the parliament is. Causing all sorts of housing and economic crises in Ireland, especially in cities. When you go to Dublin, you can still sort of go around the old British areas of the city, and they have these huge townhouses, three floors, whatever, they stretch on down these streets. And when we were driving there, I was like, do people still live in these houses? And my bus driver, this spicy little Scottish guy, told me this whole story about, nope, British cleared out, then they became tenements, these became slums, and now they're mostly businesses that are in these houses. And caused, this economic devastation that lasted for a very long time. In the middle of the 19th century, 1845, you also have this little thing called Irish potato famine from 1845 to 1852, in which 1 million people died and another million people left the country. So it went from a country of 8 million people to 6 million and continued to drop. The population continued to drop well into the 20th century due to immigration, right? This is why, you can find Irish people everywhere, and there's more people of Irish descent living outside of Ireland than in Ireland. Currently, today, the population is still only around 7 million, which is less than it was 150 years ago, which is pretty uncommon for most countries. But they are in decline again. So throughout the 19th century, there's a few more rebellions connected to this, 1803, 1848, 1868, all of which were failures in terms of driving out the English. And so this Act of Union held well for the 20th century. caught in forgetting to update my slides here.
Okay, Easter Rising, 1916. So this is the big turning point in terms of Irish independence. This was an insurrection that took place for 6 days and took place over the Easter week, hence the name. The fighting took place mostly in Dublin, which the insurrectionists had claimed as their own. There was also sort of fighting in other places as well. At the end of this week, there were 485 people that were killed. 66 of them were Irish insurrectionists killed in battle. 143 were British soldiers. 16 Irish were executed after the rising, and 260 of the dead were civilians, and 2,200 more civilians were wounded. Now, the other thing, I forgot to put this in my notes, but the other thing about this is, if you think about 1916, the British, in order to push this down, sent 17,000 troops to Ireland, right? Which, when you think about what else was going on in the world in 1916.
Middle of the First World War.
Middle of the First World War. So they were worried enough about this small insurrection that they diverted 17,000 troops to Ireland and to push this down. But what ended up happening was, after this was over, public opinion really shifted away from England, not only in Ireland, but all over, right? Because they just saw the devastation of Britain. And it did end up leading to greater independence for Ireland. There was an Irish separatist government that was elected in 1918. They declared Irish independence at that time. This led to the Irish War of Independence, right? This revolution that the British were trying to avoid ended up happening 100 years later. And this war was mostly a guerrilla war fought between the Irish Republican Army and the British forces. And it lasted from 1919 to 1921. In that time, you have the partitioning of Ireland, so you have Ireland now two countries, Northern Ireland, which is still part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is the southern part. And it eventually ended with the Anglo-Irish Treaty in 1921. So this gave Ireland independence from Britain. However, this ended up leading to more infighting, because in the midst of working on this treaty, there were two factions that formed: the pro-treaty provisional government of Ireland, and their national army, and then the anti-treaty Irish Republican Army. So these two went to war, and so you have a civil war as well from 1922 to 1923. And in that, the national army won the war, mostly by sort of securing large urban areas, including Dublin, and the IRA was sort of pushed down, right, as an actual army. So by the beginning of the 1920s, Ireland is split in two, and most of the country, though, is independent from England. The IRA continued to exist, but not as an official army, the Irish Republican Army, but as a paramilitary, some would argue, terrorist organization. We'll dig into that a little bit more. It's complicated. But they mainly operated in Northern Ireland, which was, of course, still under British rule, agitating and demonstrating for Irish independence from England. So this leads to what is often referred to as the Troubles. So this is an image of the Easter Rising from 1916. And so even though the war had ended, the unrest really did not for most of the 20th century, especially in Northern Ireland, which lasted right into the 90s and still have ramifications of it today. So these included these sorts of protests and agitations, all that kind of stuff included. Bombings targeted at civilian locations, protests, all sorts of political oppression. It also led to the segregating of cities, literally, like Belfast in Northern Ireland, to keep these sort of sectarian groups from fighting. And this is most obvious in the image of the peace walls that divide the Protestant and Catholic neighborhoods in Belfast. I'm going to come back to that a little bit later, because I want to sort of end on that. But I'll talk about it. So the other thing to note, of course, is, like I mentioned with the Protestant and Catholic thing before, sort of historically, it still isn't like these titles are euphemisms, really, for political divides, right? Like the rest of the world, Ireland is increasingly secularized, but these denominations have these kind of historical roots in political realities we've talked about. So when somebody says that they're Protestant, it usually means that they're pro-British. And what is called a unionist, right? They want to continue with the United Kingdom, right?
meaning that they want Northern Ireland to remain part of the UK. Catholics tend to be Republicans, Irish Republicans, not American Republicans, and want Northern Ireland to join the rest of the country, right, to have one united Ireland. So these groups, when we talk about Protestant versus Catholic, yeah, Catholics, we're not talking about, they're not arguing over, like, denominator doctrinal differences, right? They're not like transubstantiation, and no, you know, this is not what the argument is about. It's really, there's no sort of theology involved, right? This is the religious history that's all tied up in this sort of political history, and so while the religious aspects are still part of their identity, right? The Catholic groups, they still do things like, you know, confirmations and baptisms and things like that. It's these disputes are far more complex than which church you go to, right? Or probably go to regularly. So this is a whirlwind history of Ireland. Try to compress as much as possible. But as background, you think about certain ways that this gets expressed through art, in particular music of U2. And so we're going to do one song here that pretty well known, probably some of you know it, and it's based on a historical event within the Troubles. So this is Sunday, Lord of Sunday.
Can't believe the news today. I can't close my eyes and make it go away. How long, how long must we sing this song? How long, how long? It's tonight, we can be as one. Bottles under children's feet, bodies strewn across the dead end street. But I won't heed the battle call. Puts my back up against the wall. Sunday, bloody Sunday. Sunday, bloody Sunday. Sunday, bloody Sunday. And battle's just begun. There's many lost, but tell me who has won. Trenches dug within our hearts. Mothers, children, brothers, sisters torn apart. Sunday, bloody Sunday. Sunday, bloody Sunday. How long, how long must we sing this song? How long, how long? As one tonight. And it's true, we are. And TV reality, and today the millions cry. We eat and drink while tomorrow they die. The real battle's just begun. To claim the victory, Jesus won. On Sunday, bloody Sunday. Sunday, bloody Sunday.
Okay, so try and do this. I'm ready for the next one. Now, you two is probably the most famous band to emerge out of Ireland. All respect to Thin Lizzy, but I think they might be Calypso. And are now in their fourth decade, I think, of making music together. They formed in the late 70s at Mount Temple Comprehensive School in Dublin. And put out their first record, I think, in the 1980s. So they've been there. Now, this song, in terms of the song, the history of this song, it was based on an actual event that took place January 30th, 1972. During a demonstration in the Northern Ireland city of Derry. So if anybody's seen Derry Girls, this is where that happened. Essentially, it was just a peaceful protest, but as the protesters moved towards a building where British soldiers were set up, some of them started throwing rocks and things like that at the soldiers, and the soldiers opened fire on the crowd. And they ended up shooting 26 people. 14 of those people died that day. So Bono would have been about 11 years old when this happened, and living, you know, in Ireland, not in Northern Ireland, but this was something that really shook up a lot of people all over the country and really all over the world, as does any sort of protest when, you know, innocent people are shot by armies, right? This is sort of something that's not supposed to happen. Armies fight against armies. So he wrote about this. This is his memoir that came out a couple of years ago, and sort of his thinking about it in going into this into writing this song. So the song actually refers to what happened in the picturesque walled city of Derry, Northern Ireland, January 30th, 1972, a day tattooed on the mind of every Irish person of a certain age, a day of images we can never unsee. The chaos of a large crowd corralled and beaten by riot police, the British army stepping in with deadly force, 28 people shot, 14 of them fatally, during a peaceful protest by the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association. Even now I can sketch the pained face of Father Edward Daly holding up a blood-stained handkerchief in an ambulant prayer of "Don't shoot." I was 11 and I still feel the nausea. So this is an event, you know, that's clearly weighs heavily on him, that as he's writing his memoir 50 years later, right, still part of it. Now, what's interesting is, of course, this was and remains, I think, one of their most popular songs, but it was enormously controversial when it came out in 1983 in ways that I don't think is necessarily remembered, but Bono sort of talks about it here and just how much it sort of cost them to put this song out there. So I'm going to read for a little bit here. Once Edge is the, for those of you who don't know, the guitar player of U2's name is The Edge. Bono, it's a thing people did in the 80s, I guess, gave themselves, you know, nicknames like Sting. Edge, I'd say he's talking about writing starting to write this song. So once Edge had taken us across the border with this sketch of a song about the troubles, the band could not stop me from heading deeper and deeper into difficult territory. I feel I have a kind of perverse tick when I'm told not to say or do something. It makes it all the more attractive. Sunday Bloody Sunday was not just dangerous subject matter to be singing in the sense of obvious pitfalls if you were a kid from the South. It was actually dangerous in the sense that on hearing it, some people wanted to hurt us. Some people from both sides of the sectarian divide. For unthinking unionists, it was a betrayal. For the unthinking nationalists and Republicans, it was an advertising campaign. And one to waken a sense of outrage about these 28 unarmed civilians gunned down while making a peaceful demonstration. The songs arrived after the death of hunger striker Bobby Sands on May 5th, 1981. So he goes on here to say, too, that the IRA was not very happy with them because they sort of first thought this was a celebratory song, right? This is about Irish independence, a protest song against the British Army, but of course when you start to listen to the song, you realize that it's not quite as straightforward as taking one side or the other. Because it's really not about sort of, you know, pushing one ideological view, but about the sort of critique of violence, right? In this critique of violence, particularly as a means to peace, right? And so Bono also would declare regularly when they would play the song in concert that it wasn't a rebel song, right, which meant it was not a song in support of the IRA. And oftentimes, when people would throw Irish flags onto the stage, which was something that happened when they would tour, whether or not it just happened spontaneously or they had somebody throw a flag up there, whenever that would happen, Bono would dismantle the flag. He would rip off the orange part, he would rip off the green part, and he would just hold the white part, right, as a sort of sign of non-resistance and peace. And he did this in honor of this guy here. So his father, Edward Daly, was a priest who was at this protest, and this is what he was talking about. He says his face, you can see, he was trying to escort these people through the army lines, right, and doesn't want them to get shot, like the 28 other people, and so is waving a white flag as a sign of peace. So, U2 would, at the time, and still does, promote pathways to peace through nonviolence, diplomacy, democratic means, all of that. And don't take this as me sort of saying Bono is some sort of saint, or you know, they're also incredibly wealthy people who do all sorts of other things. You know, anyway, but this in this case, I think they are admirable in their sorts of pushing of peace, right, as a means of, or pushing of nonviolence as a means for peace. But this really didn't sit well with the IRA, especially because in their concerts they would often encourage people not to send money to the IRA, which is what's going on a lot in the 80s, is that people thought, well, this is they're fighting freedom, all of this, the IRA is trying to fundraise, and they're sort of pushing back against this. So again, he writes about this. He said, for those already pissed off that U2's opposition to paramilitaries of all kinds had cost the IRA valuable fundraising in the U.S., this was a vexed signal for their ongoing sympathizers. Some in the media to kick U2 off their national perch, especially the singer. Practically, we were advised to increase our security after a prosperous dentist had been kidnapped with the tips of his two fingers sent to ransom. When Special Branch came to see us, however, they predicted that Allie, this is Bono's wife, was the more likely target. I still take that badly for all kinds of reasons. He goes on to say, the band's hope is that Ireland will, by peaceful and democratic means, one day become a united Ireland again. Ironically, we think the biggest obstacle to that is weaponizing of grievances by the paramilitaries. So, throughout the years, Bono has taken a lot of criticism for his sort of staunch nonpartisan stance when it comes to getting things done. For instance, his work on AIDS in Africa in the late 90s, early 2000s, saw him working with all sorts of right-wing figures, people like George W. Bush, and he got a lot of criticism for it. What he did ended up working in ways that a lot of group activists and celebrities that wouldn't sort of cross the aisle didn't. And so, he talks about that for a long time in this book. But so anyway, all of that is still kind of background. I want to think about this actual song, right? So one of the refrains of the song is this question, right? How long to sing this song, right? And of course, this isn't referring to a particular song or any song, but rather this more metaphorical idea of choruses connecting to plights, right? It's a reference to Psalm 40 as well, where God gives the speaker of that poem a new song, right, to sing. But here is the sort of speaker of the song, or Bono, or something else, wonders how much longer he has to sing this old song, right? When will a new song come? One that doesn't depend on violence, the violence that's depicted in the verses, right? The broken bottles on the children's feet, back up against the wall, the mother's children, brother's sisters torn apart, all of this kind of stuff. This is the song that keeps getting sung in the name of freedom, and keeps failing people. In the original version of the song, the recorded version, the final part has this repetition. You can see here the lines with the repetition of Sunday, like, Sunday, I only have one voice, so I couldn't do it, and I told you that you didn't have to sing with me today. So, but this repetition, has this sort of parallel voice and mourns the kind of feeling of being immune to violence, right? The old song. So we could think the old song is this Sunday, Bloody Sunday, right? This Bloody Sunday violence and all of that. And violence, you know, Sunday is the Christian day of rest, the Christian day of religion, and all of that kind of stuff. To call it bloody, right, connects blood with religion, right, in this way that these groups do as well. And so, opposite of that, right, we have this sort of declaration of fact as fiction, TV reality, right? We have all of this just sort of building up as this old song keeps singing. And then in true Bono fashion, he brings Jesus in and has this line about claiming the victory that Jesus won on Sunday, Bloody Sunday. So again, this connects to a much older Bloody Friday, I guess. But, you know, this sort of connection of violence and religion and connects it back to Easter Sunday, right? Which again, is another intriguing to peace through nonviolent means, right? Which is exactly what the Easter story is about, right? The Easter story is not Jesus suddenly kicking ass and killing all the Romans and freeing Israel, right? It's about self-sacrifice, it's about nonviolence, or not fighting violence with violence. And all of that. And so in Bono's reading of this situation, right, these two groups, Protestants and Catholics, historically all the things I talked about, killing each other in the name of Jesus is accomplishing the exact opposite of what Jesus is trying to do. So eventually, this, as I said, Bloody Sunday was in the 70s. Lots of violence still happened in the 80s and the 90s. But by 1998, we have what's called the Good Friday Accords. So here's the celebration of Good Friday Accords with David Trimble and John Hume, two Irish politicians who were instrumental in signing these ceasefires and all that, and then the Mills one, who did not actually...
Was not part of the negotiations.
Oh, no. But you know, they needed some star power, so they got him to come for that. Or he invited himself. Who knows? Anyway, there he is. Yeah, so these Good Friday agreements were signed on April 10th, 1998. And so it's oftentimes that sort of marked as the end of the Troubles, but it's pretty murky for reasons that we're going to talk about in a minute, because violence, of course, has continued. But essentially, the Good Friday Accords, Good Friday Agreement, was a ceasefire agreed to by the IRA and the governing parties in Northern Ireland and the British government. And so... Even after that, of course, Northern Ireland remains a separate country from the rest of Ireland. It is part of the UK, but it is much more peaceful now than it was for most of the 20th century. And there's much more sort of cross, trade and communication between the two countries than there used to be. When you go to Northern Ireland, if you're driving, the only sign that you're now in a different country is that the way the roads are painted changes, because it's different in the UK, and the road signs change. And you can still see the remnants of checkpoints, right? They're sort of there, but they don't use them anymore. So you can just drive back and forth between different countries. But of course, this is, as I said, murky, right? The violence has continued, including an incident that inspired this next song that I want to look at and think about, which is called Peace on Earth. We're going to get into this notion of peace a little bit more.
Heaven on earth, we need it now. Sick of all of this hanging around. Sick of the sorrow, sick of the pain, sick of hearing again and again that there's gonna be peace on earth. Take you, and you become a monster. mountain will not break you. You've already gone too far to say that when you're going hard, you will get hurt. Jesus, can you take the time to throw a drowning out of life?
So he lived in this tension, right, which was pretty tense, in being this kind of mixed family in Ireland in the 60s and 70s. Right, there certainly was something about his dad going to mass while they go to another service, and what his neighbors would have thought about all that. So, well, Sunday Bloody Sunday, I think both of these are somewhat obviously pessimistic songs in a lot of ways, but Sunday Bloody Sunday has this kind of hint at optimism, right? This sort of notion of Jesus, whereas I think Peace on Earth, which also evokes Jesus, is far more pessimistic, right? And worries that there won't be peace on Earth. And it was written after this violent act. So the OMAD bombing that took place in 15th of August in 1998. So just after these Good Friday Accords. This bomb went off in a public square and it killed 29 people and injured 220 others. Among the dead were 6 teenagers, 6 children, and a woman that was pregnant with twins. So another mass, thing that really shook Ireland, shook the world, especially in the wake of what people thought was peace, right? And so this was carried out by the real Irish Republican Army, which was a splinter group from the Irish Republican Army. And this was a group of people that were very unhappy that the IRA had signed this ceasefire in the Good Friday Accords. And so they decided to start their own group and continue on this work. And so they claimed that they had not intended to attack civilians, but it seems pretty unlikely since where they put the bomb, right, it's in a very public place. The reaction to this was very strong, as I said, and it actually ended up pushing the peace process because this splinter group ended up joining the ceasefire. They stopped what they were doing. So, didn't meet their goals, but ironically, of course, did bring about
more peace. So complicated, complicated intersection, right? Because your violence brings about peace in a terrible way, as usual. So, but the pessimism here in this song, I think, has a lot to do with that refrain from Sunday Bloody Sunday about the new song, right? Bono is expressing his anguish that he's still singing the same song, right, about violence and devastation. And even, of course, he connects it to Jesus, right? The words are sticking in my throat, right? Jesus, can you take the time to bring Madeline? He even has this line about Jesus and the song you wrote. The words are sticking in my throat, right? And so this idea of if the song Jesus wrote is Christianity, say, you know, which is a bit of a leap, but if that's the case, then that song is what's sticking in his throat, right? And bothering him. And so this song that gets sung, right, in this refrain of peace on earth that we sing at Christmas, right, he's clearly evoking Christmas as well, becomes more and more meaningless for him, right, as it gets repeated. And so, you know, we have, again, this sort of dismay at still singing this same song. Now, the other thing that's interesting in this song that I really like is this listing of names that happens in the middle of the song. So these are the names of actual names of some of the victims of this bomb. And so this moment acts as a commemoration for the victims in which their names are spoken and all of the adjacent power that goes with that, right? There's a certain power to listing names. This is why war memorials often, and memorials of other tragedies, have lists of names on them, right? Not just numbers. And this is the same reason we see an emphasis in social media, right? When you have names like Breonna Taylor or George Floyd, right? The sort of insistence on repeating these names, right? Songs like Janelle Monáe's "How You Talkin' 'Bout," right, which is a list of names of Black victims of police violence, right? This sort of bringing names into the conversation gives humanity to victims that listing numbers just doesn't, right? We can hear numbers and it's tragic, but when we hear names, we know there's a story there, there's a person there, there's somebody who loved them and gave them a name, all of these kinds of things, right? And so to bring that in there brings the humanity to the story. And so, think about this idea of peace and peace walls. We're going to come back to peace walls. So, here's a map of Belfast, and you can see here the yellow. Hopefully, you can see it clear enough. The yellow are all of these peace lines, these peace walls. The sort of blue part is Catholic majority neighborhoods, and the grayer part is Protestant neighborhoods. You can see in the number of them, right? There's a divide right between the two. And these are still the way it sort of is. I also just mentioned too that both of these songs take on either sides of this divide, right? Sunday Bloody Sunday is about sort of British attacking, you know, people who want independent Ireland. Peace on Earth is about people wanting independent Ireland attacking, you know. And I think, you know, I want to sort of pick songs from two sides because, you know, this is a battle wherein atrocities were perpetrated by both sides. Right? This isn't sort of one innocent victim. And it was a vicious time to live through, especially in Northern Ireland, because of the fact that it's really hard to take one side or the other, right? Despite what your feelings are about Irish independence or colonialism, right, when violence happens, it's sometimes hard to say, well, I still support the IRA, even though they just killed a bunch of kids, right? You don't, you know, it's difficult. And so that ambivalence is important. And this violence was a big part of life and tended to radicalize people as it does, which again, you know, is a reason for these walls. So the earliest of these peace walls was actually erected before even the Berlin Wall, right, which was quite a long time ago, and has outlasted most of these walls. So they add up to about 32 kilometers of walls all over Northern Ireland, but mostly in Belfast. And the neighborhoods around them are severely economically depressed. And the people are literally kept segregated in their neighborhoods by these heavy gates. So here's an image of some of the peace walls. You can see the bottom is mostly graffiti, and they've sort of been built up. And they're quite tall. You can see that cab there is doesn't even get to sort of first floor. And then they have gates periodically, and these gates are closed at night to keep the people from the different communities separated. Now, what's interesting, of course, about these as well, is that on this? Sorry, this is my crew here, standing near a peace wall, smiling happily. Anyway, the ironies of tourism. But okay, so one of the things about these peace walls is they've gotten taller over the years, right? So they sort of built the first one, and then people were throwing things over them, or they were climbing over them when the gates closed. Build a little higher, a little higher. You can see they're quite high now, so that nobody could really climb them safely or throw things over them to keep this peace. And what's even more sort of disheartening about them is that they've actually grown in numbers since the Good Friday Awards. So there are more now than there were before that, right? So they've continued to build them to try and keep peace. Right? This is sort of the idea of these things. So, you know, and because calling them peace walls, of course, feels very ironic, right? And even Orwellian, right? Sort of 1984, war is peace, all of that kind of thing, right? And especially because 67% of all of the deaths during the sectarian violence and troubles occurred within 500 meters of these walls, right? This is where the violence is happening. And so to call them peace walls doesn't make sense, because if a community is actually living in peace, they don't need to be separated by walls, right? Walls mean these communities are not living in peace, and they need these very tall walls. So the word peace here, of course, is referring to the idea of keeping the peace, right? In the same way that people talk about their guns, the peacemaker, you know, back then, like old westerns or whatever. Keeping this peace, as though the existence of these walls keep people who hate each other apart, and so keeps things peaceful. But this is, of course, not actual peace, right? This is just a temporary measure that enforces a lack of confrontation, right? And a lack of confrontation is not peace. Not actively attacking someone is not the same as living in peace with someone, right? If I was sitting next to somebody that I actively despised or hated, just because I don't kill them doesn't mean we're living peacefully, right? We still get along. And so we can extrapolate all sorts of meanings from this in all sorts of directions, right? If we ever get a ceasefire in Gaza, for instance, between Gaza and Israel, it doesn't mean that there will be peace, right? A ceasefire is not peace. It just means a lack of aggression for a certain amount of time, right? That's something I stole from Romeo Dallaire, who was involved with Rwanda and all that sort of stuff. He said, it's on a field lecture, and one of the things that stood out, he said, we haven't had peace. We've just had a series of ceasefires. Right in the 20th century. Do you think it's true? So the political divides, right, that we see here, that we see all over the world, we see in the States, they do boil over into violence sometimes, and it shows this lack of peace, right? Even within a system, democracy, which we're told keeps the peace by replacing violence with rational, deliberate deliberation and voting, right? Rational becoming increasingly in quotes, I think. But democracy, of course, has this tendency to stroke the emotions of war by dividing us into ideological camps, right? We have to compete for who is going to be in charge. I'm picking on the States, but of course, we're seeing the same sort of thing happen in Canada, in the discourse, the political discourse, and all of that kind of stuff. So I'm not just picking on them. It happens everywhere, right? And it's this inability to live an actual peace, right? But instead live in a series of ceasefires is what is at the heart of this song, right? Bono isn't saying that the world is in a constant state of violence, although it pretty much is, but that the breaks from violence are not actually peace, as long as the violence is always at the edges, because our interactions are based on ignorance, intolerance, division, othering, misinformation, and actors, political or otherwise, who are willing to exploit those things for personal gains, right? As long as we're still fighting each other, we just, you know, when an election ends, it's like a war ends and you're going to a ceasefire, right? It's not peace. So there's never going to be peace on earth, right? This is what he keeps saying. Stop telling me there's going to be peace on earth. And so it becomes for him tiresome and trite to hear people talking about that something like this could even happen, right? And this is of course where the pessimism and all of that comes from. But I don't want to end it on so pessimistic. It's not fun for anyone, especially on an essay. But I also don't want to be naive, right? So, will there ever be peace on Earth? Probably not, right? As long as there's human beings. At least it seems pretty impossible on sort of a macro scale, right, that everybody could get along. And yet there are examples of peace all around us, right? And people moving toward peace in big ways. And in all of our lives, there's movements, there can be movements towards peace. So I'm going to hold on here and loop back to Jesus for a minute. Because Jesus, of course, is probably one of the most misused guys in history, because everybody's trying to use him to win their arguments. And of course, that leads to a lot of unrest and the opposite of peace. So whoever Jesus actually was, if we take the version of him that we get from the Gospels, we get a guy who offers a pathway towards peace, not world peace, right? At least peace within our world, right? And within our sphere. And because I really think the entirety of his message can really be boiled down to thinking about a perspective that is the opposite of our own, right? Considering the other person, right? Do unto others, love your neighbor, etc., all that sort of stuff. And it's all about this sort of act of imagination where we think beyond ourselves, our likes, dislikes, our prejudices, our ideologies, our ambitions, and consider those that we see as obstacles to us getting what we want as human beings, right? As opposed, there's countless times in the Gospels where they want him to condemn the Roman, condemn whatever. He refuses. He recognizes the humanity of others, right? Which, of course, what infuriates him. And so, for the most part, we all kind of want the same thing, I think, right? We want to be safe, we want to be comfortable, and we want to be loved, right? This is, I think, there's maybe a few other things, but these are really what all of our desires boil down to. But these ideas, of course, get perverted and blown out of proportion, right? Our desire to be safe makes us believe that everyone is ready to be violent and attack us, right? So we feel we need to be prepared for that violence with our own violence, right? And this can be, simple and innocuous, like locking your door, which is probably a good idea, but it can also build up to owning a lot of guns, right? Or wanting to go to war with another country, and then you become the violent aggressor that you're afraid of becoming, right? This is like the line in the song where it says, you become the monster so the monster will not break you, right? You become the thing that you are fighting against. Our desire to be comfortable can lead us to exploit the labor of others, right? We have our own idea, this can be economically, but we also have our own ideas of how the world should be, and that causes us to enforce our belief systems on others, even if someone else's decision has nothing to do with us, right? So insert your favorite hot-button political issue here, and we can see how a lack of imagination leads to this sort of fundamentalism, right? Sectarianism. And our desire for love as well, is a beautiful thing. Love is a beautiful thing, but it can lead to competition, to jealousy, manipulation, to abuse, right? All these sorts of things when we don't recognize the other person as human. And so all of these things come about when we stop thinking about the other, placing us as far more important than them, and way more important than we, right? And so ultimately it leaves us as sort of stuck, right? Which is why that song that we get stuck in a moment that we can't get out of. Sometimes, we are stuck by literal walls that surround our neighborhoods, but also by our own choices that are informed by our prejudices. So many times in my own life, when I don't have peace with someone or something, it's because I can't see beyond my own self-interest, right? And drives. And so I exert an enormous amount of energy arguing with myself. Sometimes Jane catches me arguing by myself, and it's embarrassing, but anyway, always talk out loud to myself since I was a kid. But it gets me nowhere, because I'm not arguing with anybody. I'm arguing with myself, right? And so in this way, to evoke another U2 song called Running to Stand Still, I end up exerting all this energy and getting nowhere, being stuck in this moment. So we're kind of over time, so I don't want to keep you here any longer. I can do this last song if you want, or we can do it. Okay.
Go ahead.
So this song isn't specifically about the troubles, but is about a sort of character who is trying to run, to stand still, and in particular using substances, substance abuse, in this case heroin, as a means of trying to escape this place that they're trapped in.
So she woke up. Woke up from where she was. Lying still. Said I gotta do something about where we're going. Step on the steam train. Step out of the driving rain. Run from the darkness in the night. Singing out, I love, I love, I love it, yeah. I love, I love, I love it, yeah. Hear the tapes in my mind. I see seven towers, but I only see one way out. You gotta cry without weeping, talk without speaking, scream without raising your voice. You know I took poison from the poison stream. Out of here, singing out, la 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 la.